Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In honor of this Black Friday, we've been listening back to some of our favorite conversations about money. We've talked about spending money, saving money, and now let's talk about big money.
$1 million isn't cool. You know what's cool?
$1 billion.
That's a clip from the film The Social Network. But in that vein, let me give you a couple of other numbers. $250 billion, $430 billion, $2 trillion. Those are the total assets held right now by TD Bank, U.S. Bank, and the Bank of America, respectively. The nation's largest banks today are, in fact, bigger than they were before the 2008 financial crisis. So, are they too big to fail? Well, that's the question we posed to Chad Gifford. He's former chairman of the Bank of America, and we spoke with him last May after his retirement. Gifford had a legendary 50-year career in the New England banking industry. And in our conversation, he said he doesn't actually think the banking industry has done a good job explaining why big banks are important.
The problems in 08, as far as I'm concerned, had many godfathers and godmothers, not just the big banks. Big banks made mistakes. But whether it's government policies, rating agencies, regulators, borrowers themselves, not shrinking back from some of the securities that were put together that went bad, which the banks were guilty of. Most of the origination of those mortgages were mortgage bankers rather than banks. But beyond that, right now, the global financial system is incredibly complicated. And trillions of transactions, maybe not trillions, but billions of transactions a day. And if anybody, in my opinion, who's rational, can take the big banks out of that with their levels of capital, their expertise, I think they're crazy. So I think that's important. We'll have another downturn. And when another downturn happens, who is going to help the government out of the jungle?
People would say it would be the taxpayers.
Well, we'll get to that. We will get to that. What's happened? You know, Bear Stearns got into trouble. J.P. Morgan took them over. Merrill Lynch was tottering. Bank of America took them over. The government needs those kind of allies when we have difficulty.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, because, you know, right now there is a lot of talk about the role that the banks play in the U.S. economy. And I'm wondering if we could just take it down to the level of current voters. Say that you were talking to, you know, a young person who's 30. They graduated from college and entered the economy right after 08. And they've had a tough time sort of getting a foothold in terms of growing their own wealth and their life. Or say you were talking about a worker on the edge of retirement who's seen their earning power progressively drop over the past 30 years, and a lot of job uncertainty, a lot of retirement uncertainty, et cetera. How would you tell them that their lives have felt an impact or a positive impact from the big banks?
Well, number one, since 08, the deposits of the big banks, and let's say the big banks being Wells, Citibank, JP Morgan, Bank of America, deposits have grown. People aren't running away from us. If somebody says break up the big banks, who are they going to tell, okay, I'm sorry, Megan, you can't do business with one of these banks again anymore. They're going to be broken up. What are you going to say to the corporations, small and large, that provide the services? Our business is growing because we have products to grow it. So we live in a populous world where anything big, not just banks. Here in Massachusetts, I'm on the board of partners in Mass General, which I think that Mass General is one of the incredible institutions in this region or this country. We criticize for our size. Everybody gets on big things. We watch the heat that Google starts taking, given their remarkable control of information. So, but what we've learned, I think, from Trump and from Sanders in particular, is there is tremendous anger out there. The middle class is not growing as it should. So wages have been stagnant. And I think some of the rhetoric of vitriol doesn't help, but rather, what can we do about it?
Yeah. You know, I'm really grateful and eager to hear your detailed perspective on this because of your long history in the financial industry. I mean, as you know, just last month, in April, the Federal Reserve and the FDIC put out a letter, a report, saying that 5 out of 8 of the nation's largest banks don't yet have what they called credible plans for winding down in the event of another crisis. Bank of America was one of those banks. And Thomas Honig, the vice chairman of the FDIC, said in a statement that the goal to end too big to fail and protect the American taxpayer by ending bailouts remains just that, only a goal.
There are a number of regulators that don't think we should have big banks. The Fed also said, and I believe the FDIC as well, that the banks have made remarkable improvement in getting here. In my opinion, the bank that I retired as a director from last week is the strongest financial institution I've ever been part of. And that goes back the 50 bloody years I've been in the bank, measured by capital ratios, measured by the quality of the credit portfolio. So I dispute the issue that we still are vulnerable to failing banks.
So two things there. One is it seems that the federal government itself disagrees with you because they said that the current arrangements could pose serious and adverse effects to the financial stability of the United States. And you seem to be saying completely the opposite.
Obviously, I don't agree with that comment. As I tried to say earlier, I believe the big banks are absolutely critical when times get tough because of their strength, because of their management expertise. Yes, they're very large. You have banks like ours with a diversity of cash flow, not dependent on certain geographies. We saw the problems in New England back 20 years ago. When you're dependent on one local geography, you're vulnerable. One local product, you're vulnerable. The big banks are much more diversified than that. So, yes, I disagree with those comments. You say the federal government. The federal government's pretty large.
Well, in this case, it's the Fed and the FDIC.
Yeah, but if you read the entire report, I think you'd see great progress. I know you say it because it's written that way.
So I guess maybe I already know your answer to this, but I have sort of this fundamental philosophical question. And let's just accept for a moment that there are a lot of people, some of whom are very influential, who do believe that the big banks are too big to fail, and they have a problem with that. Let's just accept that for a moment. And I'm wondering what you think about this, that if our economy, both in the United States and globally, is so fundamentally reliant on these enormous institutions to function as they need to in the 21st century, and it's those same institutions that people are worried could bring down the economy, as we saw we were at the cusp of in 2008, isn't there a fundamental structural problem with that relationship?
To me, the risk in the next time we have a tough 08 type of thing won't be the big banks. It'll be the people like the hedge funds. It'll be the unregulated, the so-called shadow banks, which have very large positions, which have very large investments without the capital strength, without the management expertise that I think the big banks have. You know, one of the other things that irritates me is when people say banks don't want regulations. That's crazy. Banks must have regulations. I think, frankly, many of the regulations are one of the reasons we are the strongest in the world.
You know, it's easy to think that this concern about the role that these enormous financial institutions play in the economy, that it's sort of the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warrens of the world who are most vocal about those concerns. But, you know, I was remembering that Neil Kashkari, who's currently the head of the Federal Reserve in Minneapolis, and he served in the Treasury Department under Hank Paulson in the administration of George W. Bush, he, back in February, gave a speech where he himself proposed that breaking up the big banks should be something that the United States does consider doing. I mean, he said, and this is a quote from his February 2016 speech, he said, "When the technology bubble burst in 2000, it was very painful for Silicon Valley and for tech investors, but it did not represent a systemic risk to our economy. Large banks must similarly be able to make mistakes, even very big mistakes, without requiring taxpayer bailouts and without triggering widespread economic damage. That must be our goal." That's what he said. And then he went on to recommend breaking up the large banks into smaller, less connected entities. He even added turning large banks into public utilities by forcing them to hold so much capital that they virtually can't fail. And then, in addition, he said maybe we ought to consider taxing leverage throughout the whole financial system to reduce systemic risk. I mean, that is virtually unimaginable with the current situation we have. But I bring this up because it's not just Elizabeth Warren. It's not just Bernie Sanders. Here's someone who served as a Republican in the Treasury who also has these concerns.
You've picked two people, Honig and the chap in Minneapolis, who absolutely have said what you just said. They have made it very clear that they think the big banks should be broken up. That's two regulators out of hundreds. hardly a majority. So in my opinion, there are many others in the same fraternity, very experienced, understand the importance that the big banks play. By the way, one thing, Senator Sanders, and again, I think he and Trump has hit upon great unease in our country in terms of income disparity, true job growth, Main Street, Wall Street. And we all have to acknowledge that. I want them to sit down and say, okay, be part of a discussion. You break up the big banks. That sounds terrific. What is the collateral damage?
You mentioned the word unease in terms of people's unease with the concept of these big banks and the roles that they play. 2008 is why there's so much unease.
Absolutely.
Today. I mean, and it was Bank of America itself that made, back in 2014, an almost $17 billion settlement with the government, the largest ever for a single American entity for, as the DOJ categorizes it, financial fraud leading up to and during the financial crisis. So, there's a lot of people who say, look, I heard you say earlier, Chad Gifford, that there were a lot of players in the run-up to 2008, hedge funds, mortgage generators, the countrywides of America. But many, many people say that it wouldn't have cascaded through the economy the way it did had it not been for the big banks, who were then, in part putting money out for these loans and coming back and securitizing them and then selling them off, and that the very thing that you say they're good at, which is handling the complexity, is what allowed the crisis to, threaten the U.S. economy. I guess what I'm getting at is, given our recent history, what's the way forward to get past that unease?
You're 100% right. The unease, the litigation settlements, mm-hmm. $17 billion, and there were others as well, has clearly given us a black mark. And if I weren't involved, as I think I am, and have the experience that I think I do, reading about all those settlements, I would be angry as hell. I'm not a lawyer. I think a lot of the settlements blew us away. I'd like to think those are done. As it relates to the specific crisis in 08, it was obviously residential real estate, home prices down 35%. Residential homes for almost everybody, individuals and institutions, residential mortgages, a diversified group of residential mortgages, were for 40 years the AAA1 credit. The fact is there were some many subprime mortgages made that should have been made. Most of those were not, as it relates to Bank of America, most of that was Countrywide, as you probably know, which we bought in 07 or 08, whatever. We didn't make the mortgages. We bought it, so yeah, it's on our candle.
Well, you didn't make them, but then you securitized them and sold the securities.
We did, but remember, it was the AAA1. Remember, until 09, Moody's and Standard & Poor's had these things rated AAA1. The thought that the mentality of the companies, the big banks, were knowingly securitizing lousy loans, I think is preposterous.
Well, but isn't that exactly what happened with Goldman Sachs, though?
Well, I think that what happened to Goldman Sachs is probably the same that's happened to everybody. I don't know if that's unique.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, what was it, in 2010 or so, at a federal hearing, there were some emails that were presented to Lloyd Blankfein when he was testifying that basically seemed to show that Goldman was knowingly selling securities, mortgage-backed securities, that they knew weren't as highly rated as they should be, that they were essentially toxic, and then also shorting those same securities.
I think that's terrible. I don't think that was not widespread when you talk about, particularly that latter statement, shorting those same securities. I think as the market heated up, there was what I still consider some bad actors, and I think we could have been more careful on that. But again, I think that's basically indicting a community when you have one or two bad apples.
Mm. I'm not in the business of pinning all the blame on individual bad actors, because this is a complex system that we have, right? So from your perspective, post-Dodd-Frank, Because I heard you say a little earlier that bankers actually love regulation
or need
regulation. I'm just wondering.
We respect regulation.
Okay, you respect regulation. What are there specific things in addition to Dodd-Frank that you think could help further stabilize the system or prevent, you know, future 2008s?
I think we have enough regulation right now. I don't think I'm not proposing more regulation.
Okay. Well, let's. I'm going to totally shift gears here because you've been quite a gentleman regarding the too big to fail question. It's possibly one of the most important points of discussion, I think, both politically and economically.
And even as we sit here, I'm not sure I've done a good enough job explaining why I believe we would be much worse off without the strong large banks. I think they play an incredibly pivotal job in this society. Small business, residential, large companies, institutional. And I think we would be worse off without J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo and Citigroup and the Bank of America.
What if there was a new form of Glass-Steagall? I mean, could you have the same capacity, the same expertise, the same wherewithal, but with just that additional protection put in?
I think, on balance, we'd be worse off with another aspect of Glass-Steagall. I think what Glass-Steagall did for our customers, and we really try to think of our customers. You do the job for customers, you're going to do the job for shareholders. Particularly those with sophisticated financing requirements, not just global, but wanting to hedge certain parts of the business. It's Glass-Steagall which allows us to do that, to raise equity for companies. And I think America and free enterprise, and for me, it's free enterprise. It's taking risk to make a profit. It's taking risk, and you make a profit, you grow, and you employ. I believe the banks strongly help that, enable that.
Last question. So you started off in the world of banking as a loan officer, right?
Right.
Right there at the retail level. I'm just wondering.
The commercial level.
Commercial banking as a loan officer. I'm just curious if there were any lessons in those early years that stayed with you as you went from that, you know, all the way to leading some of the world's largest financial institutions.
Sure. Credit is still the principal component of our balance sheet, which means loans. As a young officer, I made a lousy loan. And I learned then what can go wrong. And when you make a loan, you start with the character of the person. You have to have a little cynic in you about what could be on the downside, and it helped prepare me. One thing that when I was made elected president of the bank, 89, however long that is, Dick Hill, who was my predecessor by two, an incredible man, said, "Remember, Chad, your most important job is to make sure you open the doors the next morning." That's always stayed with me.
Well, Chad Gifford, thank you so much for your time and for talking with me. I'm really grateful for it.
No, it was fun. Thank you. My pleasure. I'm not sure I convinced you about big banks, but I believe I'm right.
Chad Gifford is a 50-year veteran of the New England financial industry and a longtime civic leader and philanthropist in Boston. We spoke with him last May after his retirement from the board of directors of Bank of America.
Now, who's hot, who not? Tell me who rock, who sell out in the stores? You tell me who...
Well, that's it for today's special Black Friday edition of Radio Boston. And before we go, let me leave you with this one final thought from the brilliant satirist Jonathan Swift. It's a couple of centuries old, but as relevant today as it was when Swift first said it. A wise person should have money in their head, but not in their heart. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a great weekend. This is Radio Boston.
B-I-G-P-O-P-P-A. No info for the DEA. Federal agents mad cause I'm flagrant. Tap myself and the phone in the basement. My team supreme, stay clean. Triple beam, miracle dream. I'll be that. Catch a seat at all events bent. It's in holsters, girl.